Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic shows a disabled vehicle on I-10 westbound. It's blocking the right lane at the 202 Santan Freeway. Elsewhere, an accident I-10 westbound at Dysart Road. Partly sunny skies in the Valley forecast for the rest of the day today. There is still a slight chance we could see some rain with a high of 94 degrees. 99 is average for today. Partly cloudy skies tonight. Overnight lows near 80. Partly sunny skies tomorrow and Sunday. Slight chance of storms. Highs each day of 98. It's 94 degrees at KJZZ. Governor Jan Brewer has appointed her top in-house lawyer as a Superior Court judge in Maricopa County. Joseph Sherrata Jr. is expected to take the bench early next year. He's been Brewer's general counsel since 2011 and advised her on proposed legislation, contracts, and constitutional issues. He's also defended her Medicaid expansion plan in court and defended the governor when she made cuts to the program in 2011. Brewer says the nonpartisan Maricopa County Commission on Trial Court Appointments unanimously recommended Sherrata. Brewer praised him for helping the state through some of the most economically and legally challenging years in its history. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell says he made a mistake in his initial response to multiple accusations of domestic violence involving NFL players by not responding in a clear and timely manner. In a news conference today, Goodell said the league will change its personal conduct policies for players, coaches, and staff, and that the NFL is partnering with two national domestic and sexual violence prevention organizations. According to Goodell, the National Domestic Violence Hotline saw an 84% spike in calls last week, and the organization didn't have the resources to respond to even half of those calls.
What we want to be able to do is to be able to help provide assistance to them, and that was something we could do. And we said to them, we want to be involved, we want to help, and we will provide resources and assistance to be able to make sure that you can get the personnel there to be able to answer those questions.
Goodell says the league hopes to have changes to the NFL's personal conduct policy in place by the Super Bowl this February in Glendale. Arizona Cardinal Jonathan Dwyer this week became the latest NFL player to be accused of domestic violence. He spent a night in jail and has been deactivated from team activities. So what should we make of this recent spate of allegations? For answers, we turn to Ashley Durfee. She's an associate professor of women and gender studies at ASU School of Social Transformation. She's also a big football fan.
Football is really important in our house. We have NFL Sunday ticket. We spend most of Sunday in front of the TV.
And you're also in more than one fantasy football league.
Three, actually. Yeah.
So is it important to you to have players on your team that aren't in the headlines for things other than sports?
It is very important. So before we choose our teams, because two of our leagues are not auto-draft, we talk about how we want to cheer for players that we have a lot of respect for, both on and off the field, that have a lot of integrity. And so when players exhibit behaviors that, to me, aren't something I want to cheer for, I do not draft them, no matter how many points they would give my team.
With all the news about Ray Rice and then Adrian Peterson, now Jonathan Dwyer and some other players thrown in there, what are the questions that we should be asking?
I think one of the questions we should be asking is, how do we help people draw boundaries? So we have a society that enjoys a lot of sports. I'm a big football fan, but it's a violent sport. And if you have an especially good hit, like last night in Tampa Bay-Atlanta game, there was an especially good hit that forced a turnover. They play it over again, and I literally said out loud, that was a great hit. So, and when players get pumped up, they get angry. And we tell kids, right? I mean, get fired up, get angry. So how do you de-link getting fired up and getting angry from violent behavior off the field? How do you learn to draw the boundary between what is actually kind of you're working for on the field versus what's not acceptable in society off the field?
How do you do that?
Well, I think it takes a lot of conversations, and it's going to take a lot of role modeling. So I think this is a really unique opportunity for the NFL, not only to sanction players, but also to have players step up and talk about how they have healthy relationships, how they draw that boundary.
You kind of alluded to this, but I'm curious if you think that there is actually more of this bad behavior going on, or if we just know more about it now.
Well, we know that actually 1 in 3 women will be abused, and pretty close to that now, men will be abused by an intimate partner in their lifetime. So this is something that's going on not just in football, but throughout society, and we're not talking about it.
It's interesting you bring that up about how it's not just women who are abused, that men can be abused too. There's a case going on right now with the goalie of the U.S. women's soccer team who is accused in a domestic violence case, who has been playing and hasn't really gotten as much attention as the football players who have been accused of similar kinds of things. Why do you think it is that some of these cases get more attention and others don't?
Well, that's been a hard case for me, too, because I'm from Seattle, and I actually watched a lot of Hope Solo's games when she played for the University of Washington. So I follow a lot of women's soccer as well, and so that's been something that I'm struggling with. But again, I think that has a lot to do with boundaries. As a goalie, you have to be very aggressive to defend that goal. So how do you learn not to bring that over in other types of relationships? And that's not necessarily only in intimate relationships in her case, right? There's familial violence. So how do players learn to treat other people and their family, not just their partner, respectfully?
Do you expect to hear about more cases of domestic abuse coming from either professional football or other professional sports?
I think yes and no. I think that people are going to be more comfortable coming forward. So I think that they see that players will be held accountable, and I think that's wonderful because no one should ever be allowed to do these behaviors. People need to be held accountable for them. At the same time, if we only sanction players and do not follow that up with anything else, it sends the message to someone who's a victim of these types of violent acts that if you come forward, only bad things will happen. But if we can stop and say, how can we help you? We're worried about you. We want you to be safe. How do we help you become safer in all aspects of your life?
Alicia Durfee is an associate professor of women and gender studies at the ASU School of Social Transformation. Alicia, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Enterovirus D68 has officially been confirmed in 12 states, and Arizona has sent samples to the Centers for Disease Control to find out whether it's here as well. The respiratory illness that develops from the virus is primarily affecting teens and younger kids. Dr. Rebecca Sonnenschein is the medical director for the Maricopa County Health Department's Disease Control Division.
For some reason, it rapidly progresses to respiratory distress, and a lot of children who are getting this disease are going into the hospital and having to go into the intensive care unit on a ventilator very quickly.
How is the illness spreading from state to state?
Well, enteroviruses are one of those respiratory viruses that can affect everybody. The reason why the disease seems to be so much more severe in children is because they've been exposed to less enteroviruses in the past, so they don't have any immunity built up. Adults can just as easily get these enteroviruses, but because they've been exposed so many times, they tend to have very mild symptoms or no symptoms at all. They spread very quickly through the community through coughing and sneezing and all the usual ways. And somebody gets on a plane, they infect the person next to them, and it's very easy for them to jump from city to city.
What are you watching for in terms of trends?
The most important thing that public health is doing is we're keeping our eye out for clusters of respiratory illness, especially severe disease in children. We put the word out to all the doctors and healthcare providers, hey, this is a really severe strain. If you see a group of people or clusters of people that have severe respiratory illness, even if they don't have a fever, they can end up on a ventilator. If they're seeing those, they need to call us, let us know, and we'll help them get the special testing from the CDC to identify this particular strain. In addition to notifying providers and helping them investigate, we're making sure that these individuals have the appropriate infection control precautions so that people are wearing a mask when they're around them and that it's not spreading to other people.
What does the special testing entail?
It is a viral subtyping. Bottom line is a lot of labs around here can test for an enterovirus, but they can't test for the D68 part. So we have to send a swab off to CDC so they can determine whether it's this particular enterovirus causing the disease.
Are kids who have asthma issues potentially more susceptible?
Yes. So what they've identified in the Chicago cluster and the Missouri cluster is that children who have underlying asthma definitely are at increased risk for severe disease. The other interesting thing about this disease is that you don't necessarily have to have a fever in order for it to become very severe. And I think that's unusual for respiratory illness.
Is there advice you'd give to people so it doesn't become a panic situation of my child is showing some of these symptoms?
Absolutely. I think it's very important for parents to keep things in perspective. I'm a mom myself, and when my child gets sick, I'm an infectious diseases doctor, and I always want to jump to the worst thing. But the first thing you want to do is keep your child home from school. Keep them from spreading it to others. Take care of them. Give them fluids. Treat their symptoms. And then teach them about good cough hygiene. Make sure you cover your cough. Make sure you wash your hands after you touch your mouth or nose. And in general, wash your hands before you eat and after you use the bathroom. And those things will keep not only this enterovirus from spreading, but also flu and all these other respiratory viruses that make our kids sick.
Dr. Rebecca Sonnenschein, the medical director for the Maricopa County Health Department's Disease Control Division.
The people of Scotland have chosen to remain a part of the United Kingdom. A narrow vote may have temporarily divided the country, but as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports on Thursday night, a Scottish group in Phoenix used the occasion to come together.
Farewell, my aged father.
At Rosie McCaffrey's, a noisy bar near 7th Street and Camelback, William Paul's thick brogue cuts through the crowd.
I was born under a king, and by God's grace, I'll die under a king.
Paul was one of about 50 people at a party hosted by the Phoenix Caledonia Society watching the returns come in for the Scottish vote on independence. He's been in the States since 1967, but there's no question as to where he's from.
I'm a Scot, as you might gather.
Paul is a unionist, meaning he supports a United Kingdom that includes Scotland. As the votes come in for his home county in the rural western part of the country, he isn't surprised at the result.
I think they use their mind rather than their emotions. They think things out and vote. And that's why I think it went no for them.
David McBee is the club's treasurer. His parents were both orphans, and with little family knowledge to go on, he assumed he was of Irish descent. After joining the Caledonia Society, he learned he's actually Scottish. Like many people at the event, McBee wears a kilt bearing the pattern of his clan.
It's similar to military colors, gang colors, that sort of thing. The Highlanders were family tribes.
While he was hoping for a yes vote, he says the sense of identity he's gained from the group will always remain. Society President Mark Clark says many expats like himself were hoping for independence.
I think it's people that have moved here always miss the country they come from, so they pass on the stories, the romance, the beauty of the land, the culture. They really miss it so much. So that's why they'd be more inclined to go for the yes vote.
Despite the no vote, Clark says his countrymen will carry on here and abroad.
End of the day, you know, it's still Scotland. Nothing's going to change Scotland.
Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Scotland rejected independence by a 10-point margin in a referendum that attracted a record turnout. The Better Together campaign won in areas where the pro-independence nationalists had expected to prosper. Accepting defeat, Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond said there was a substantial support for independence in the future. The BBC Scotland correspondent Colin Blaine sums up the night's events from Edinburgh.
The campaign to achieve Scottish independence has come up short. Even though the Yes camp won a majority of votes in some areas, they failed in the end to secure enough support. From the early declarations, a pattern was set in which the Yes side didn't do as well as they'd hoped. And as the night drew to a close, jubilant supporters of the Union added the capital Edinburgh to their list of successes.
No, 194,000... 638.
One remarkable feature of this referendum was that voters turned out in their droves. Scotland hasn't seen anything like it for 60 years. Across the country, turnout was 84%. This morning, Alex Salmond described that as a triumph for the democratic process.
That's the BBC's Colin Blaine. Along with political and social implications, the independence vote also had an economic impact. The UK currency, the pound sterling, has surged on the currency markets following the result. Sterling hit a two-year high against the euro in morning trading in Tokyo, while it rose 3 cents against the dollar. The BBC's economics correspondent Andrew Walker reports.
It was in the currency markets that the uncertainty generated by the referendum has been most apparent. What currency would an independent Scotland use, and how would assets and debts be divided? The uncertainty is now over, and traders have been buying sterling, pushing its value up. The pound was hit quite hard 2 weeks ago when the opinion polls suggested that the pro-independence campaign had a serious chance of winning. Now that Scotland has voted to stay in the UK, a substantial part of the earlier downward move in sterling has been reversed.
That's the BBC's Andrew Walker. Still to come, it's election season, which means it's ballot printing season, and one printer isn't worried about paper losing out.
There will be no bigger prize for hackers all over the world than to go after the presidential election in the United States.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Steve Goldstein is out today. Quick check of Valley traffic shows accidents. US 60 westbound at Bell Road. That's in the West Valley, and it has the right lanes blocked there. Elsewhere, an accident I-10 westbound at Dysart. It'll be partly sunny across the valley for the rest of the day today and right on through the weekend. 10% chance of showers and storms each day as well. Look for a high today of 94, 98 for both tomorrow and Sunday. It's sunny and 95 degrees at KJZZ at 221.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership. Debuting the all-new 2015 Outback, 33 mpg fuel efficiency and built for your active lifestyle. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
Early voting starts for November's general election in less than 3 weeks, and that means for Kevin Runbeck, it's go time. Runbeck owns Runbeck Election Services, which prints all of the ballots used in Maricopa and Pima counties, as well as counties in other states, including Florida, California, and Colorado. The noise from the plant, which you're hearing now, was so loud we had to step into another room to actually talk. Runbeck says he'll print almost 10 million ballots for next month's general election. He says there are a lot of steps between determining which candidates make the ballot and it ending up in your mailbox.
The first, obviously, is for the county to lay out the ballot. Once that's all decided, they send us PDFs of the finalized ballot layout and design. From there, we're internalizing, organizing, and preparing for print. We do print on demand here, so we're printing one ballot per voter and keeping track of who gets what.
Runbeck says from there, the ballots are printed. They go to bindery, where they're cut, folded, and assembled, and then to the mailroom. There, workers and computers match each ballot to its voter's ID, print envelopes with both outbound and return address information, sort them, make a record of each ballot sent out, and take them to the post office. And if you live in Maricopa County, when you mail your early ballot back, it comes here. Runbeck says while he prints ballots year-round, right about now is the busy season as election officials send in their ballot layouts.
They all come at once, and they all need them tomorrow.
In the time that you've been doing this, how has sort of the business of it and the logistics of doing it evolved and changed?
Well, it's radically changed because what used to be done, if you remember the butterfly ballots, the punch card systems, Arizona used to do all of those ballots that way. When you started changing to optical scan, which would be in the mid-90s, that changed the technology necessary to do the ballots. We started to have to, the printing requirements became very, very stringent. Since that time, we've gone from offset printing to variable data toner-based printing, which is like your laser printers and things like that, which each technology has had its issues. And now, as you saw earlier today, we're on inkjet technology, which allows us to do faster, better, cheaper. And that's really the pressure that we're always on, to do more for less.
How has the increase in early voting and mail voting, especially here in Arizona, affected how you do your job?
Well, our, as you saw, our mailroom is now fully half our building. And so mail processing has become a huge component, both the outbound and the inbound tracking of that, and making sure it's 100% correct every single time is quite a challenge. So we have a lot of technology plus human intervention to do that.
Do you think that elections will ever be done without paper?
Well, some of them are being done that way right now. But I think the pressure has been some sort of system via the internet. I mean, we bank on the internet. We do everything else on the internet. Why can't we vote on the internet? And my simple observation to that is that there will be no bigger prize for hackers all over the world than to go after the presidential election in the United States. And that's why I think we need to stay with paper for the foreseeable future. Someday we'll figure it out, but not soon.
Are you an early voter?
Yes, I am.
What's your reaction when you get your ballot in the mail?
Actually, it's kind of fun to get something you know you produced in the mail. Absolutely.
Do you look at it to make sure that everything is okay, that everything, like the alignment is right and there are no like white spots in the ink, or do you just look at the candidates for whom you'll be voting?
No, I look at the whole thing. I can't help myself. I got to check it.
Kevin Runbeck is the owner of Runbeck Election Services. Arizona's third biggest city has a new mayor. John Giles was sworn in last night, becoming Mesa's 40th mayor. He replaces Alex Finter, who took over after former Mayor Scott Smith stepped down earlier this year to run for the GOP nomination for governor. Giles isn't new to city government. He was a member of the city council in the 90s. He says the city's quite a bit different now, and he wants to keep that momentum going.
One of the main reasons I returned to city government is the enthusiasm that I saw in what Mayor Smith and those who were working with him have been able to do in Mesa. So I'm very interested in continuing, particularly the emphasis on economic development and on working hard to attract major employers to Mesa with good, high-quality jobs. Mesa is a large city, and we have our share of challenges, but I think a lot of the cosmetic and social and financial issues that we struggle with are going to be helped greatly if we can improve our economic base and bring more high-paying jobs to our community.
What do you think is your city's biggest challenge or the top couple biggest challenges you're facing?
We are a very mixed bag as a city. The challenges that we face are somewhat dependent on what part of town you're driving through when you're having this conversation. In the west side, around Fiesta Mall and in the neighborhoods that I grew up in as a kid, we struggle with blight and with trying to reuse, for example, retail spaces and large shopping malls whose time is, you know, probably not here anymore. In the Far East, it's exactly the opposite. We struggle to get the infrastructure in place so that those parts of our communities can grow and develop as they to meet the potential that they have.
One of the areas that had been growing very quickly, as you know, is the area around Gateway Airport. Recently, some airlines have pulled back or stopped flying into there. What is the role of the city as far as making sure that that remains a vibrant and viable part of the city?
Given my prior experience on the council, there's really nothing that's been more exciting to me to come back to city government and see what has happened out in the Gateway Airport area. When I was on the council back in the 90s, Gateway was a place that had a lot of potential and had a 10,000-foot runway and absolutely nothing else. So it's just been exciting for me to go back to that part of town now and see where freeways and universities and airports and just everything and master planned communities with beautiful homes. It has all come together in a great combination out there, and that's where we're going to see thousands, literally, of jobs that will be the backbone of our community for another generation. That's where they're going to locate.
Do you see your term as mayor to be sort of a continuation of Mayor Smith's time here? Do you see a lot of differences between either your management styles or the policies you want to pursue? Are there things that he did do or didn't do that you would do differently?
Well, I certainly envy the success that Scott Smith had. You can't argue with that. And he has done me a huge favor in that the office of mayor of Mesa is much different now than it was before Scott Smith got here. It's much more impactful. And I'm grateful for the great job that Scott Smith has done and the way he set a plate for me that I am very grateful for. But Scott and I are very different people. I think we have the same agenda in that we want to promote economic development as our top priority. My personality and Scott's are different, I would be horribly unsuccessful in this job if my approach was to try to be Scott Smith. My personality, my way of approaching things is different, but I think that's okay. I think we'll hopefully both be very effective at the end of the day.
John Giles is the new mayor of Mesa. John, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
KJZZ is exploring what it means to be part of a community in a series called We Are the Valley. This week, we take a look at an Iraqi refugee community in Phoenix. There are more than 10,000 Iraqi refugees who have come to the Valley since the 1990s. It's the second largest group of refugees in the area after Vietnamese. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan has more.
On a Tuesday in West Phoenix, the Iraqi American Peace and Friendship Society is buzzing. There are a handful of people using computers in the lobby. Three artists are painting in a nearby studio. And in another room, about half a dozen people are taking English class.
My daughters are helping.
Fatima Alziri is the youth program coordinator at the center. She herself is a refugee who came to the U.S. with her family in 2003. And she's seeing the community grow a lot.
We always meet together and talk and share a lot of stuff and ideas, and we always talk about Iraq.
Since coming to a new country can be so daunting, Alziri says it helps to be able to talk about it with others.
What makes it easier on refugees is connecting with the older refugees who's been here longer and they know the system, they have their own experience, and they guide the new refugees.
Having a guide is especially useful because the culture here is so different than in Iraq.
The system is a huge barrier. For example, here you use internet, social media all the time. Back in Middle East, it's not like that. It's words by mouth. You go to places and that's how you connect and talk.
And since many newly settled Iraqis aren't connecting online over Facebook or Twitter, coming to the Peace and Friendship Society creates those new connections. Nada Al-Rube is painting a picture of a sailor paddling a boat on the ocean with only her fingers. She's mixing acrylic paints to make the perfect sky blue. She's lived in Phoenix for a year and not only comes to the center to paint, but also to meet the other Iraqi American artists.
It's good because if you work together, it's the work is nice and we have something fun together.
The studio where the artists work is small. They built their own easels out of 2x4s and paint over used canvases. But fellow painter Qasim Aid says it reminds him of painting back home.
When I was in Baghdad, we work in like the shops and we visit each other and talk to each other. I don't come here to, I need this studio. Hard work to come on bus and take more time. But I like to come here to see people. Yes, to meet people, talk to people.
It's also a good way to find common ground with others in the community. Fatima Alziri says art allowed her to connect to American culture when she first moved to the States in eighth grade.
One of the classes that made me want to go to school every single day was the art class. I just loved the class. It just made me alive because not speaking the language and not having too many friends and feeling being isolated because you're different is really difficult, especially in the first couple of years.
Looking back at Nada Al-Rube's painting of the ocean, she says that the art helped break the ice when she was meeting new people. And she says painting with others is important to her creative process.
Talking about the art, maybe I give him some new idea, or he give me idea, or he tell me about my work, something I don't know.
And you probably wouldn't expect it, but some artists like Qasim Aid help supplement their income by selling their work. Many of the artists meet together monthly to strategize about how to sell their paintings. Fatima Alziri helps organize those efforts.
We decided to do some galleries, art walks together. And that's how the word got around. And then a few other artists also came in to our organization.
That's because Alziri decided to start displaying some of the artists' work, which led to a few sales.
I am as a bridge in between the Iraqis and the Americans. And that's really great, great feeling that I can give back to the Iraqi community and to the American community at the same time.
Alziri says the Iraqi community is diverse: Shia, Sunni, Christian, Chaldean, but they can all come together at this center. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you're part of a community and want to tell us about it, you can write to wearethevalley@kjzz.org and be sure to stay tuned to KJZZ for more parts of the We Are the Valley series. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Ken Rathbun. We are going to pre-trip my school bus for the day. I look underneath the bus, first of all, for any new fluids. If there's fluids under there, I just stop right there and go ask for another bus. We check the interior of the bus, make sure that the seats are all secure. Also in the bus, we have our emergency exit windows. We want to check and make sure that they are operating and that there's an emergency buzzer that sounds. Now that we know that the other workings of the bus are in good order, this is the part where we do our brake check. And what we need to happen is have this valve automatically pop itself out. And there it went. So we know the bus is ready to be used.
That's Ken Rathbun preparing his school bus for the day at the Tempe Union High School District bus yard. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want us to hop on the bus, Gus, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. How does Arizona stack up against other states in terms of having laws against human trafficking? Polaris, a national anti-human trafficking group, says it's getting better, but still has some work to do. The organization released its state ratings this week, which track the presence or absence of 12 different kinds of anti-trafficking laws in states, including victim assistance, asset forfeiture, and training for law enforcement. Brittany Vanderhoof, Polaris's policy counsel, says laws may not always stop trafficking, but they can help victims.
We know that there are 21 million people, or it's an estimated 21 million people are enslaved globally. We know that human trafficking is a $150 billion global industry. So we know that it's happening despite the presence of these laws. So I'm not sure if we can talk about a deterrent effect, but what we can talk about is how the laws enable law enforcement to go after the perpetrators and also to support the survivors once they're out of that situation.
It looks like, based on your most recent ratings, that Arizona is getting better, but still not fantastic as far as having laws on the books to combat trafficking.
Arizona is absolutely doing better. A bill was passed this year, HB 2454, and as a result of that, Arizona climbed up a tier in our state ratings report. In terms of where Arizona can do a little bit better, it is in that victim services category. So making sure that all victims across the state are protected from being prosecuted for offenses they were forced to commit as a result of being trafficked. Those with convictions, allowing them to have those convictions removed from their record, and making sure that children in particular are being protected from being sex trafficked.
It looked like there were some states that did a lot better this year than they have in past years. And I'm curious, what are some of the things that those states did that maybe Arizona could look at and say, oh, maybe we could do some of that stuff as well?
Most of the states that really climbed up in the ratings this year enacted pieces of the Uniform Law Commission's Uniform Act on the prevention of and remedies for human trafficking. What the uniform law does is it provides guidance to states, it provides them a basis and suggested legislation. And what we saw was Delaware in particular passed most of the Uniform Law Commission, passed those recommendations, enacted them into law, and went from being in our tier three, so second to last, to having a perfect score this year.
Based on what you know about Arizona, are you optimistic that the state will continue working on this issue and try to make some of the changes in state law that, at least in your mind, will improve the situation here?
I am. I think that there's a lot of momentum in Arizona right now. I think that there are a few people that have really stepped up to the plate and have brought just a lot of awareness in the state about the issue of trafficking. Also, the Super Bowl coming to Arizona has raised the profile of anti-trafficking work in the state. And so while a lot of the talk around the Super Bowl is happening there, I think that human trafficking will continue to be a big part of the discussion.
Brittany Vanderhoof is policy counsel for the group Polaris.
Researchers from Northern Arizona University traveled to Alaska and Switzerland, among other places, in a quest to learn how the Earth's climate has changed over time. It's the subject of a documentary called Taking Earth's Temperature, Delving into Climate's Past.
Climate change. The words have become as inescapable as climate itself. Some people see recent heat waves and killer storms as hard evidence that humans have destabilized the world's atmosphere. Others look deep into Earth's history and see ever-changing conditions.
It showcases the life that paleoclimatologists lead in terms of this dichotomy between going to these amazing places in the remote Arctic and then coming back to the lab and trying to understand what this all means.
Nick McKay is an assistant professor in NAU's School of Earth Sciences and Sustainability and is one of the researchers featured in the film. His job primarily was data synthesis.
So looking at all the various paleoclimate records that the different regional groups used and the different estimates of past temperature over the past 2,000 years in each of these continental scale regions, and trying to put them together and understand what they're telling us in terms of how regions were different and where they were the same and what can we learn from that.
How did you boil it down? How were you able to synthesize the information into something understandable?
There was a lot going on. A lot of the regions have different kinds of data. Some regions were just exclusively had tree rings for their source of information. And then the other end of the spectrum was like the Arctic that had, you know, ice cores and lakes and trees and evidence from caves. And so, and we ended up focusing on what were the major patterns, what are the things that show up no matter how you slice the data, how you look at it. And the major thing was that most regions were cooling for the most part over the past 2,000 years. The predominant trend was getting colder and colder. Each century was on average colder than the one before it until the 20th century, which in all of the regions except for Antarctica was much warmer than the trend would have projected it to be.
There is among some this controversy over whether climate change is man-made or not. Is that relevant to the documentary and what we're talking about?
I think studying the climate change of the past has tremendous scientific value for this reason, right? I mean, I think most people know or they understand or they've at least been told that climate has changed in the past. And you know, some people think of this as sort of just natural cycles and this is just what climate is going to do. But what we, as paleoclimatologists or for people who study these climates of the past, our ultimate goal is to both understand what has changed and really the important part is why. We've been doing this for a long time. We really understand what the major things that cause climate to change are. This is great, and we can look at the natural experiments that the Earth has conducted for us in the past in terms of climate to understand, okay, when there's a big volcanic eruption, how does that influence climate? If the sun gets a little bit weaker for 100 years, how does that influence climate? If there's changes in ocean circulation, how does that influence climate? And we really use this paleoclimate data as a testbed to understand those things.
Nick McKay, an assistant professor in NAU's School of Earth Sciences and Sustainability, is one of the researchers featured in the film Taking Earth's Temperature, Delving into Climate's Past. It'll air on Channel 8 Saturday at 5 p.m.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Still to come, the fall TV season is underway and the shows and characters are starting to look a little different.
Critics like me have been saying that this is an advantage of diversity in media for a long time, but it took a while, I think, to convince especially the broadcast networks that this is true.
That's ahead. It's the show. couple of problem spots on Valley Freeways, I-10 westbound, an accident at Dysart, I-10 westbound at Avondale as well. The shoulders blocked in both of those places. 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at Gilbert Road, has the shoulder blocked there. It'll be partly sunny throughout the weekend. Slight chance of showers and storms each day. Look for highs tomorrow and Sunday of 98 degrees. It's sunny at 95 at KJZZ at 244.
KJZZ, supported by Musica Nova Orchestra, hosting the Art of Senegalese Sabar Drumming, featuring Dr. Sonia Branch and friends. Scottsdale Presbyterian Church, Hayden and Osborne, 3 p.m. this Sunday. No ticket required. MusicaNovaAZ.com.
You've probably had the pizza place around the corner put a flyer on your doorknob. You've also seen the countless TV commercials by major corporations. All of that falls into the category of marketing. But what if you want to get more people to worship at your church or temple?
We're trying to, in a sense, create a different feeling when you think about church, just like milk did back in the 80s, that milk does a body good. And we're trying to make people believe that church is a great start to an amazing week.
Scott Anderson is co-senior pastor of Scottsdale's Living Word Bible Church. This weekend, the church will be hosting presentations by Keith Hudson, who's better known as singer Katy Perry's dad.
Beer doesn't sell beer. They sell an emotion. You know, you think that, you know, you grow up and you watch all the commercials, you think if you pop open a beer that, you know, five girls are going to jump out of an ice chest and you're going to have a party. Well, they didn't tell you anything about beer. Instead, they just sold you an emotion. And I think that we're trying to, in a sense, let people that have a wrong perception of what church is out there know that church is fun and God is good.
But there are a lot of churchgoers who may not be comfortable with the idea of marketing or something stronger to get more people in the pews.
You think marketing is a tough word in the church world? Well, let's talk about brand.
Richard Rising is author of Church Marketing 101. He says every church is different, but the methods cover a familiar gamut.
We see social media marketing, we see direct mail, we see billboards. We pretty much see much of what we see in the corporate marketing world in order to try and just give people a sense that we might be a church, or that any particular church might be the kind of church that someone might be looking for as they're looking for answers in life.
But Rising says a negative reaction in marketing a church isn't much different from what he's heard from corporate clients. He cites one specific example.
When we first started out in this, I remember working with a church. We did a 10,000-piece mailer, and as a result of that 10,000-piece mailer, they had 300 people come, which... That's in direct mail terms, that's a home run. But about a month or two later, the pastor called us and said, you know what, of those 300 people that came, none of them came back. We think the mailer was a failure. And so we kind of scratched our heads and said, well, was the mailer the failure?
Support for marketing in general doesn't always come down to more predictable generational differences. Jason Anderson, co-senior pastor with his brother Scott at Living Word Bible Church, says his parents were early advocates of the idea.
My mom has always said that the church will be built through marketing. And marketing is not much different than evangelism. It is, but it isn't. As Jesus would walk around the streets and near the lake and talk to the people, so also when you run a radio ad, you're in someone's car, right? You're in their world. If you run a TV ad, you're in their home. And so what a great access to promote a message even for just a short period of time and remind people.
Anderson says marketing isn't new to him. He remembers his father placing ads in the local newspaper's movie section, photoshopping his own face under the bodies of film heroes like Indiana Jones in the effort to attract more churchgoers. For the appearance of Katy Perry's dad this weekend, the Andersons are using something closer to home, the marquee right in front of their church.
For more than 80 years, he was identified by a number until the federal government decided his resting place should be more befitting a military hero. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us the story.
Isaiah Mays was a corporal in the United States Army in the 1880s. He was awarded the Medal of Honor in 1890. Did you know Mays was buried at the Arizona State Hospital Cemetery until 2009, when it was discovered he was never given a proper burial?
He's
one of only two African Americans to receive the medal as a result of actions in Arizona.
John Langelier is the director of the Arizona Historical Society Museum at Papago Park. He's also a military historian.
In his case, it's because of the fact that he was guarding, along with another contingent of black troopers, the payroll of over $20,000 that, like in some great old Hollywood movie, is set upon by bandits.
In today's dollars, the payroll was in the hundreds of thousands. As we tour the museum's latest exhibit, Arizona and the Medal of Honor, Langelier recounts the story behind May's historic action. He says May's was part of the 24th Infantry. He, along with other soldiers, were traveling between Forts Grant and Thomas on May 11, 1889. They were escorting Paymaster Major Joseph Wham when they were attacked.
He fought literally with his life to protect the payroll of his fellow soldiers, received an abdominal wound, and was wounded in both arms. Now, in those days, the weapons were heavy and they were one shot, so even though he's wounded with his arms being almost incapacitated, and yet he survived and continued to fight.
Langelier says no one was killed in the attack and the bandits got away with the money. He says it's believed locals of a nearby community known to have paid off their debts with money that miraculously appeared may have been the ones who planned the robbery. In less than a year after the incident, Mays was awarded the Medal of Honor. But after that, little is known about what happened to him. Langelier says he ultimately ended up at the Territorial Insane Asylum, today the Arizona State Hospital.
He's at the state hospital because he has no money, and when he passes, that's where he's laid to rest.
Corporal Isaiah Mays died on May 2nd, 1925, at the age of 65. He was buried with hundreds of other hospital patients at the time in a lot near Roosevelt and 28th Streets. In 2009, Mays' remains were disinterred, cremated, and placed in an urn designed specifically for him, and was interred with military honors at Arlington National Cemetery. Langelier says Mays' Medal of Honor has never been found. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we should know, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. In about 2 weeks, we'll bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this word puzzle. A woman gave her daughter 10 cents and another daughter 15 cents. What time is it? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item.
The traditional fall television season, the one that features the ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox networks, hit screens this week. But several of the new programs are less traditional and feature more Latino and African-American actors and performers. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans says that's an indication the old guard media outlets recognize there are a couple of advantages to ethnic and cultural diversity in programming.
The first is that you get characters that are unique, that we haven't seen on television before, and you get stories that are unique that we haven't necessarily seen on television before or in media before. And you're also reaching out to this audience that previously has not been catered to very much on television. And so you're reaching out to underserved audiences, you're creating unique new characters that the entire audience finds compelling, and you're also finding storylines that are unexpected and that are new and that help these shows feel very much like they're very contemporary. And you know, critics like me have been saying that this is an advantage of diversity in media for a long time, but it took a while, I think, to convince especially the broadcast networks that this is true, that this is real, that this is a dynamic that they can take advantage of. And I think they're discovering that now, and they've really devoted a lot of resources to creating shows that reflect this ethic in the new fall season.
One of the programs I've seen previewed was Black-ish with Anthony Anderson.
My name is Andre Johnson. I have a great career, a spectacular house, and a loving family I'm surrounded by every day. But as a Black man with all this success, sometimes I feel like an oddity.
If you look to your left, you'll see the mythical and majestic Black family.
And not to live in a Pollyanna world here, but is the goal to have a time where, whether it's African-American performers or Latino actors or whatnot, in a show and we don't notice what color they are, or are we looking more for getting that cultural impact that, as you mentioned, people have not seen much on television?
If you think about the people of color that are in your life, you will know that there are times when their culture is a very big part of what they're experiencing as a person, and there are times when it isn't. And so the key is to create characters that are unique, fully formed, well-developed characters all their own, but they also exist within their own culture. And part of the problem that TV especially has had is that you have characters who reflect their culture, but that is the most important thing about them. Or you have characters of color who don't reflect their culture at all, and they're whitewashed, and they could be a white character, but they're just played by a person of color. And the key is to create characters that are informed by their culture, but are not entirely of and about their culture.
What difference is it making, too, in the fact that millennials, though they use television much differently than many of us do, they tend to be closer to colorblind or seeing color as something that they think is something they want to learn more about?
Millennials are not free from racial issues or racial problems or racial stereotypes. They just have different ones. And they struggle with race in a different way, but it is very much a struggle. I wind up having at least one kid of color, you know, when I give a speech at a college, I have one kid of color who comes up to me very emotional, struggling with how to reconcile who they are with what society expects them to be based on what their ethnicity is or what their culture is. Having diversity in media helps everyone negotiate these issues. In particular, though, it helps kids who may be struggling with these issues, struggling to figure out how to feel about these things, how to feel about themselves, how to feel about people that are in their lives that might be their playmates or might be their friends. And to assume that any one generation is free from these issues is to make a huge mistake.
NPR's TV critic, Eric Deggans.
If you're like me and can't make it out to a kegger on a regular basis, you may wonder what the cool kids are listening to these days, but don't worry, we've got you covered. The music streaming service Spotify created a list of the top 40 most musical universities in America, and ASU came in number 7. The data are based on people who have special student subscriptions to Spotify and came from the last 3 months or so of spring semester. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry reports that according to Spotify, ASU students really love singer and songwriter Lana Del Rey.
This is an artist that Arizona State University students listen to proportionally more than all of the other schools we looked at. So it's not just that there's a lot of listening, it's like significantly more than the other schools on average.
That's Elliot Van Buskirk, data storyteller for Spotify Insights. He says in addition to loving Lana, there are a few other musicians ASU students like more than other schools, like Chris Brown and dubstep artist Skrillex. But the data show some other qualities unique to ASU too.
A huge one was staying up late.
Spotify puts the typical bedtime for an ASU student at 2 a.m., an hour later than other schools. That's based on what time they start and stop listening to music, like Calvin Harris's Summer. The data also break down in terms of song attributes. That is to say, what qualities listeners are looking for in music. It might not seem like it, but ASU students listen to music with a lot of acousticness, meaning a more stripped down, less electronic sound, but not music with something referred to simply as hotness. For the record, that's spelled with 3 T's and 3 S's.
Hotness is buzziness, essentially. So it's possible that Arizona State University students are cutting-edge listeners and are ahead of the other students, you know, in terms of listening to what's going to be hot and hasn't been picked up by the blogs yet.
And another thing ASU students like more than usual, a genre called tropical, featuring Latin music styles like cumbia and bachata, songs like El Malo by Aventura. Okay, so what do they not like? Spotify says Miles Davis and Nickelback. No need to play that last one, but we did stop by ASU to see if the data stacked up. With just a random sampling of a few students, here's what they had to say.
Amber Lugo.
Andrea Peterson.
Stefan Benitez.
Yosef Alazimi.
Favorite artist would probably be Miguel.
Tim McGraw.
Probably Avenged Sevenfold.
Kendrick Lamar.
Girl, I'm Kendrick Lamar, a.k.a. Benz is to me just a car.
I don't know, I don't really have a favorite song this week.
0 to 100 for Drake.
Shake It Off by Taylor Swift.
I stay out too late. Got nothing in my brain. That's what people say. That's what people say. I go on too many.
That was KJZZ's Sarah Ventry with help from Caitlin Stein. We want to know what you listen to and where it ranks on the hotness scale. Lots of T's and S's in there. Tell us what you love by tweeting at us at KJZZ Phoenix.